I never expected so many people today for our sutta class. Because all I only photocopied 8 copies of the book. I was thinking that, being this is the first sutta class for a while, I just announced it on Friday. I must admit, never expected so many. But there's 8 copies of what we're going to do today. The first 8 to come up, on your marks, get set. Here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Still another one to come. Okay, there we go. That's it. If you haven't got one, then please share with the person sitting next to you. Okay, so these are, for those of you who've been to the Sutta study class before, that sometimes when either myself, one of the other monks, or Ajahn Sister Wayama comes up here, we talk about Buddhism from our own experience, from our understanding. But every now and again it's great to go to the original teachings of the Buddha. And those original teachings are found in what's called the suttas. The word sutta is literally means threads. And just like a cloth is woven from threads, so the teachings of Buddhism are woven from the many talks, individual talks, which the Buddha gave during his life. And each talk is like a thread, and altogether that makes up the cloth, the robe of Buddhism. So they're called suttas. And there are many collections of suttas. There are 5 main collections, and those are the long discourses, the Digha Nikaya. And don't usually read those out, because just one sutta, one teaching, takes quite a long time. And there's the middle-length suttas, which I usually use for reading out in these classes, because they're just a nice length to be able to read, to discuss in about an hour and a half or so. And there's 2 other collections, the Anguttara and the Sanghutta, which are very short, and sometimes in order to use them as a sutta class, you have to get 3 or 4 together to make it really interesting. And that gets a bit more difficult. And lastly, the Kudaka Nikaya, which hasn't really been translated. It's a bit of a mishmash, a bit of this and a bit of that. So for the sutta class, we usually read the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length sayings. And for those of you who want to come regularly to this class, it's probably a good idea to buy one of the books. It's a very good translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Sometimes I disagree with some of the words, sometimes give them a slightly different meaning, but I usually tell you when that is, and you can understand why through the explanations we give during the classes. But it's a very, very accurate and well worth purchasing if you want to come to these classes. And not only that you can keep them at home, keep that book at home and start reading them, reading some of the suttas. And it gives you an understanding of what the Buddha actually taught. There are many types of Buddhism found in the world, but it's great actually to find out what the original Buddhism was. And this is as close as you can get to what the original Buddhism was. And once you find out the original Buddhism, then you can actually understand where all the other types of Buddhism came from. You can understand just how they developed one particular aspect of original Buddhism. They may have neglected another aspect, how they add on things, subtract things. But at least you know the core, which we all hold in common. And that way you can have a lot of harmony between the different Buddhist teachings and sects which you find in our modern world. So these are very, very good teachings. And they give a much fuller understanding of what Buddhism really is. So that being said, that during these classes held usually fortnightly on the 2nd and 4th Sunday of the month, either myself or another monk or sister will actually read out from one of these, one of the suttas from this collection of 152 suttas. And as we read them through, we'll discuss them, answer any questions, and sometimes elaborate on some of the ideas which are contained in those suttas. And those of you who have copies of those books, you are very welcome actually to suggest the sutta you want to read out the next time. And I'm very happy to do that. Because I think most of these suttas we've read out at least once. And if you have one which you find is a bit interesting for you, or which you don't really understand, you'd like it to be read out, please let me know, and we'll read it out at the next time. But for the first sutta, I just chose one myself, one of my favourite suttas, which is the Arana Vibhanga Sutta, and I think it's number 139 in the book. And the reason I chose it is because it's a simple sutta, but it goes from some of the most refined parts of Buddhism to the ordinary matters of daily life. And whatever it says is, I've always found very, very profound. And so it's a short sutta, but a deep sutta, which has the ordinary practices of daily life and some of the high practices of meditation, all included in this one little teaching. So it's the Arana Vibhanga Sutta, on page, sutta number 139. Okay? Now, because it's a sutta teaching the Buddha, I usually do the Namo Tassa first of all. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So here we have the 139th sutta in the middle length sayings, the Arana Vibhanga Sutta, the exposition of non-conflict. We start off, thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove and Anathapindika's Park. When a sutta starts like that, it means that thus I have heard is the usual beginning of a sutta. And when it says, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sarvati, Jeta's Grove, one of the other places where he used to live, this was almost like a key to know that this was at a time when the Buddha was alive. There are a few suttas in these collections which misses that out, and that's the indication that was something which was said or done just after the Buddha's parinibbana. And also it shows actually where the Buddha was. It locates it in the many different places where the Buddha lived in India. And for those of you who have been on pilgrimage or will be on pilgrimage, when actually you read these suttas and you hear these names, the Jeta Grove or the Vulture Peak, and you actually go to those places, you can actually form a picture of where this event actually happened, where this teaching occurred. And that really fills out a lot of the details. If you haven't been there yet, one day please go to those holy places in India where the Buddha lived. They're very full of the energy of seclusion. They're quiet places away from the towns and cities. And they still have an atmosphere of seclusion. Still many of the ruins of the old buildings are there. And you can actually go to the Jeta Grove and Anathapindika's Park. And you're very certain that that was the place where the Buddha delivered such teachings as the exposition of non-conflict. There the Blessed One addressed the monks thus, "Monks, Venerable Sir," they replied, the Blessed One said this, "Monks, I shall teach you an exposition of non-conflict. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say." "Yes, Venerable Sir," the Bhikkhus replied, and the Blessed One said this, "One should not pursue sensual pleasure, which is low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial, and which one should not pursue self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. The middle way discovered by the Tathagata avoids both extremes. Giving vision, giving knowledge, it leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. One should know what it is to extol and what it is to disparage, and knowing both, one should neither extol nor disparage, but should teach only Dhamma. One should know how to define pleasure, and knowing that, one should pursue pleasure within oneself. One should not utter covert speech, and one should not utter overt, sharp speech. One should speak unhurriedly, not hurriedly. One should not insist on local language, and one should not either override normal usage. This is a summary of the exposition of non-conflict." Now, this is obviously just a summary here, and this particular sutta now expands on those things. Obviously, the reason why they're called non-conflict is because they do lead to conflict in the world. The middle way avoids a lot of conflict. The extolling, disparaging creates conflict. Teaching only Dhamma stops conflict. And speaking properly avoids conflict. one of the reasons I like this sutta is because it is many hundreds of years, 2,500 years before modern psychology, but it still understands just how one can avoid conflict in the world, especially at the family level, political level, by understanding this extolling and disparaging business. But anyway, that's the summary, and now the Buddha is going to expand on them. So, there shouldn't be any questions yet, but are there any questions? Okay, so let's get the questions. So, yeah, you go. This is all going to be explained in a moment, because that's like a summary, like almost like headings, and then little by little, as we go through this sutta, it'll all be explained. That's why I said there shouldn't be much questions, because everything's going to be explained coming up. So this is the first, almost like chapter, where he's saying the chapter heading again: one should not pursue sensual pleasure, which is low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial, and one should not pursue self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. So it was said, and with reference to what was this said? Now, of course, this is all about conflict. So they're saying here that if you pursue either sensual pleasure or self-mortification, you're going to have some conflict somewhere. Maybe conflict with the body or conflict with others. Now he's just defining it now. The pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasures is linked to sensual desires. Now it doesn't actually say in here, but it says in a little bit later down, what sensual desires means is like the happiness which you get from either seeing beautiful things, pleasing things, hearing, smelling, tasting, like good food, or touching pleasant physical sensations. That's what's called sensory desires. There's another type of desire which is missed out in that. Which one is that? Is that all the desires are called sensory desires? That's right. It's the pleasures of the mind. In Buddhism, there always were six senses. This concerns the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching. Deliberately, it pushes aside, it separates out the pleasures of the mind from the pleasures of the five senses. Pleasures of the five senses are called sensory pleasure. The pleasures of the mind are called something else. So when it says one should not pursue sensual pleasures, which is low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial, and one should not pursue self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial, so it was said, with reference to what was this said, pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasures are linked to sensual desires, the five senses, is low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial. It is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the wrong way. Is that true? When you have a beautiful food, nice sex, when you see a great movie, is that low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, unbeneficial? Is it a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever? Why is that the wrong way? Impermanent, that's one thing, yeah. Sometimes that the movie finishes, and what you're left with, you want to see the next one. Some of the movies which people see, sometimes they're weepies, and you go out having with red eyes, having used many tissues. or sometimes, as it happened to one of our caretakers once, his sensory pleasure was watching the cricket, and having worked here all day, he videotaped one of the important cricket matches, and after finishing his duties here, he went into that house just now where Lynn lives, next door, and with a friend, they turned on the television, and they watched a cricket match, and it was very tight. It was very exciting. It was all down to the last ball to see who would win. And then the videotape ran out. Because there were some delays. You know, because they did an extra 15 or 20 minutes than it should have finished. But it was just, this literally, this was the last ball. You asked Jasper, our caretaker then, that's what happened. The very last ball, it cut out. And because they didn't listen to any news, because they didn't want to spoil the fun, and they had to wait the following day to find out what happened on the last ball. You see, it's a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair and fever. You never know what's going to happen next. It's impermanent, uncertain. So this is what the Buddha is saying. It's the wrong way to attach you to enlightenment. Disengagement from the pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasures are linked to sensual desire, the five senses, low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble and unbeneficial, is a state without suffering, vexation, despair and fever. It is the right way. It's disengagement from these things. Disengagement from the pursuit of sensory pleasure. He says is the right way. Another way of calling that is letting go, non-attachment, renouncing, which we've heard many times before. And this is actually what it means. Disengagement from the pursuit of pleasure. And it's very nice the way it's put there, the pursuit of pleasure. Because sometimes the pleasure will come from you. You have to eat. Sometimes you see nice things, but it's the pursuing it which the Buddha is calling here, talking about here, not running after it. Because life, they will have some pleasure, some pain. Some beautiful experiences and some unpleasant experiences. But it's a pursuing which is born of craving. That, he said, is the wrong way. So don't pursue pleasure. If pleasure comes to you, that's fine. Don't run away from the pain. It'll go by itself. Stop all the pursuing. There's also the opposite sometimes of especially some religious people, the pursuit of self-mortification, painful, ignoble and unbeneficial. Is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair and fever. It is the wrong way. Of course, that's pretty easy to understand. Self-mortification, standing on one leg, facing the sun all day, as some people do, or going without clothes in the cold weather, or sort of not fasting, or whatever else you tend to want to do. It is the wrong way. But disengagement from the pursuit of self-mortification, painfully ignoble and unbeneficial, is a state without suffering, vexation, despair and fever, and it is the right way. Now, to understand even more fully what these two extremes are, and these are the two extremes which the middle way of the Buddha avoids, you see, both of those extremes, the Buddha said, is a state with suffering, and their disengagement from them is a state without suffering. So you can always tell what is the right way by seeing just how much peace and happiness and freedom it gives you. If it's a state without suffering, then you're obviously going in the right direction. That's the right way. Because sometimes people can read these books and get completely the wrong message because they don't understand it. But that is the final acid test. Your practice is the state with suffering or without suffering. So sometimes people indulge. They come to the Buddhist center and afterwards they go to the pub. Maybe even go to the brothel. And they do all sorts of stupid things. But is it a state with suffering or not suffering? Some others, they say, right, I'm going to sit meditation all day. I'm going to become enlightened this week. And they sit there, their knees are aching, their back is aching. They're getting even more stressed through meditating much longer than ever done before than they usually have. Is that a state with suffering or without suffering? Obviously, a state with suffering. They're going in the wrong direction. That's not the right way. Now, the middle way is in between. But before we get to that, the Buddha sums up this. So it is with reference to this that it was said one should not pursue sensual pleasure, which is low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial, and one should not pursue self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. It's common sense really, isn't it? Why would you pursue something which is painful? Why would you pursue something which is ignoble and unbeneficial? Why do people do that? Any idea? Yeah. That's one reason, yeah, just the expression of your identity. You think, I have to do this. Sometimes people experience suffering and pain because they think that in the end they're going to get something out of it. I'll be happy when, and I'll get rid of this. I'll work hard and suffer, because in the end I'll be happy. I will just work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to make my fortune, because then I can retire when I'm 40. Then I'll be happy. So some of these ways which we really misunderstand just what real happiness is, we can actually have a lot of pain and suffering. Other times, it's because of the way we are deluded. We bend our perceptions, we bend our experiences to suit ourselves. In the same way, when I was a teenager, that it was a time of first introduction of drugs, and somebody was going around saying that banana peel, if you put it in some metal foil and keep it for 2 or 3 days, it turns into this hallucinogenic substance and it gets you high. So a couple of my stupid friends tried that. And after they say, oh yeah, it really works and it makes you high. It's just complete wishful thinking. They just psyched themselves into being high. Just because, you know, they'd gone to all that trouble and they'd feel like fools if they didn't. Then of course later on it was, you know, the scientists proved there's nothing there at all. It was just absolute, just wishful thinking. So because of wishful thinking, if you go on a holiday somewhere and you pay thousands and thousands of dollars, of course you're going to come back and say it was a wonderful time. Just recently in Sydney, just one of the sons of my disciple over there, they went to one of these weekends of a motivational psychologist from the United States, was hired this big hotel on the Gold Coast, and they charged him something like $7,000 for the weekend. And so this stupid kid paid $7,000 for this motivational course. I said, oh, you can come and hear them even better stuff at your mother's temple when I go and give a talk. But I asked him afterwards, what was it like? Was it good? Oh, it was really great. It was wonderful. And I said, well, you have to say that if you forked out $7,000, wouldn't you? You feel such a fool to say it was a waste of money. Who could ever say that? The point was, your wishful thinking will actually bend the truth to suit yourself. And that's why that sometimes we have some pleasures which we actually say are worthwhile. That we don't say that they are painful. They are really painful, but we refuse to admit it. Or there's some pains we say are pleasurable because we refuse to admit it. That's one of the problems with human beings. They don't see things as they truly are. They see the world as they want it to be, as they expect it to be, or as they're taught it to be. And of course, you know, one of the other experiences was drinking alcohol. Now, I was a rebel. I mean, continue to be a rebel. When everybody said in, you know, being brought up in UK that beer was a great thing to drink. First time as a young man I drank beer, I couldn't believe that so many people were paying money for this. And a terrible tasting liquid. It was so bitter, it didn't taste beautiful at all. Why were people doing this? Because everybody else said it tasted nice, that's why. So you got a taste for it after many years. People go out getting drunk at parties, like the schoolies will soon do. What do that for? Because every other schoolie does that. It's, you know, it's tradition. They don't think for themselves. They don't question. But actually, when you actually question it, I can't see any fun there at all. It's much more fun not drinking. You've got all your alertness and awareness there. You can enjoy life much more. That's just an example. What some people take to be pleasure, the Buddha said, the enlightened one sees suffering. What people in the world say is suffering, the enlightened one says happiness. Third asava is, yeah, a delusion. Delusion, yeah. When you read these suttas, sometimes you see that word, ignorance. I always prefer the word delusion. It's not that you don't know these things, it's just delusion, you get bent. You give things a meaning they don't deserve. The Buddha actually uses like the metaphor of a mirage, or like a rainbow. And when a kid sees a rainbow, if you haven't heard any more, you know, haven't gone to school, you think that rainbow is real, it's real colours, and it's only just, you know, 20 or 30 metres in front of you. And you're convinced that if you walk, you'll be able to reach the end of the rainbow. then it moves away from you. You can't grab it. It's a very beautiful description of like the happiness of this world. You can actually see it. It's just over there. It's within reach. But when you go after it, it just also goes away from you. You can never quite reach the end of a rainbow. It promises you can reach there, but you never can. It looks solid. It's only later on you realize that that's a real phenomena. You didn't imagine it. You just gave it a meaning it didn't deserve. And this is the thing with the experiences. You give it a meaning, pleasure, that it didn't deserve. Okay. Middle way. Oh, sorry, you got Joel? Disengage from sensual pleasure, distance from dispassion. It is dispassion, because the passion we have for things is that where these are places where we repeatedly go to. These are pleasures we go seeking. We pursue those pleasures. For example, if you've got a passion for beer, alcohol, you go to the pub or the bar regularly. When you disengage, you just stop going. And eventually, you know, your passion for those things just disappears and fades. You know, what's the point? You're not getting any interest there anymore. So yes, that's true. Ah, yes, yes. That's right, yes. But sometimes in our life, that sometimes we do get lazy in our pursuit of truth and pursuit of reality. We have a lot of interest in that when we're very young. But after a while we tend to get lazy, sloppy. So this is good enough for me. Someone has a lifestyle. Yeah, I know it's not the best, but this is good enough for me. And you settle for things which are far less than what you can get in life. And sometimes that's true. Yeah, you know, it might be not most beautiful girl, but she'll do for me. Might not be the best husband, but yeah, you know, fair enough. Might not be the best life, the best job. Yeah, this will do. And one doesn't actually pursue the understanding of happiness and the end of suffering enough to actually to fully penetrate the truth. One stays in delusion. Because uncovering delusion can sometimes be too painful. So those are the two extremes of the pursuit of the pleasures of the five senses or the pursuit of self-mortification, hurting oneself, depriving oneself of comfort. And you've seen that before in the Four Noble Truths. The first teaching of the Buddha was to avoid the two extremes and to follow the middle way. And now we come to the middle way. The middle way discovered by the Tathagata, that's the Buddha, avoids both these extremes, giving vision, giving knowledge, it leads to peace, the direct knowledge, to enlightenment and nirvana. So it was said, and with reference to what was it said? It is just this noble eightfold path, that is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So it was with reference to this that it was said, the middle way discovered by the Tathagata avoids both these extremes, gives vision, gives knowledge, it leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana. Now, one can actually extend this in a very beautiful way. This is, it avoids seeking sensory pleasure. The pleasures of the five senses are not the way. The Buddha says that if you want to get vision, knowledge, peace, direct knowledge, enlightenment, nirvana, pursuit of the pleasures of the senses aren't the way. If you try self-mortification, again, it's not the way. For all of those words, when it gives vision, gives knowledge, I always like the words leading to peace. There's a lovely word in Pali called upasama. And when you have these words from a foreign language, under a foreign culture, to really understand these words in a philosophical or metaphysical sense, it's great when you find examples of these words used in everyday speech. unfortunately, that word was used by ordinary people when they had any business and they settled that business. That was called upasama. The business was settled. So that gives you a good idea of what we mean by peace. There was something to be done, something to be done, some business, some task to be performed. It's done, it's settled, it's done away with. That's called peace. The end of busyness. Very nice understanding of what that word really means. You've washed your dishes, now there's peace. You've done your job, that's peace. The work has been done. It leads to that peace. And it also, too, when you've got knowledge and direct knowledge, those two words, jnana and abhijnana, first of all, jnana is almost like not a deep knowledge. Abhijnana means a really deep understanding of the cause of things, the underlying truth. So it's a deeper truth. And to enlightenment to nirvana. So it was said, and the way to that is the Eightfold Path. So one can know what the Eightfold Path is, not by just analysing it, you know, its eight factors. You can understand it by knowing its function, what it does. The Eightfold Path is supposed to avoid the two extremes, so it shouldn't be causing you pain and pleasure. Pain or indulgence in the pleasures of the senses. It's there to give vision, knowledge, peace, knowledge, enlightenment, nirvana. That's its function. And I mention that because one of my favorite teachings of the Buddha was where he said that whatever leads to peace, to freedom, to vision, to enlightenment, that you can know as a teaching of the Buddha. That was given to the first bhikkhuni, Mahaprajapati, also given to the monk Upali, as a teaching in brief, where you can really understand what the heart of the Buddha's teachings are. Whatever leads to direct vision, to knowledge, to peace, to freedom, to nirvana, that is Buddhism. And if you can't see it that way, you see it as the Eightfold Path. Does that make sense? Okay, let's go further then. So that's actually, here's a sutta which is amplifying, extending what many people read in the teaching on the Four Noble Truths, the Dhammacakka Sutta, the first teaching of the Buddha, where he said you should avoid the two extremes and walk the middle way. This extends it and explains it in greater detail. Okay. I should also mention that the middle of the Eightfold Path, what's called a right speech, right action, right livelihood, is usually what we call morality or virtue, keeping precepts. So the Buddha is actually mentioning here very clearly that these precepts, because they're part of the Eightfold Path, they lead to peace. That keeping the precepts is part of the middle way, so it should not lead to suffering, vexation, despair and fever. Because many people in modern societies think if you keep precepts, oh, it's just too hard. You're just going to be lead to vexation. You're not really expressing your natural desires, and therefore you lead to some sort of suffering or despair. But the Buddha is actually saying very much the opposite here. If you keep a restraint according to precepts, it does not lead to suffering or to vexation, despair, but it leads to peace. So keeping precepts leads to a happiness. Okay. Now the next section here goes on to another part of creating conflict. This is more worldly conflict. And this is very wonderful because many of you, I've seen myself doing this before, forget about this teaching which is to come and thereby create an awful lot of conflict, either in your family, in your monastery, or in your community, or even in your nation. So listen carefully to this. This is a very obvious point, but a point which too often we forget. One should know what it is to extol, one should know what it is to disparage, and knowing both, one should neither extol nor disparage, but should teach only Dhamma. So it was said. With reference to what was this said? How, bhikkhus, does there come to be extolling and disparaging and failure to teach only the Dhamma? When one says, this is just for example, all those engaged in the pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasures is linked to sensual desire, low, etc., and unbeneficial, they are beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they have entered upon the wrong way. One thus disparages some. When one says, all those disengaged from the pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasures are linked to sensual desire, low, etc., are without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they have entered upon the right way, thus one extols some. When one says, all those engaged in the pursuit of self-mortification, painfully ignoble and beneficial, are beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they have entered upon the wrong way, one thus disparages some. When one says, all those disengaged from the pursuit of self-mortification, painfully ignoble and unbeneficial, are without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they have entered upon the right way, one thus extols some. When one says, all those who have not abandoned the fetter of being are beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they have entered upon the wrong way, one thus disparages some. When one says, all those who have abandoned the fetter of being are without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they have entered upon the right way, one thus extols some. This is how there comes to be extolling, disparaging, and failure to teach only the Dhamma. Now, before I go on to what it's added here, we haven't had before the fetter of being. Put that aside for a moment. I'll come back to that in a minute. And how amongst does there come to be neither extolling nor disparaging, but teaching only the Dhamma? When one does not say all those engaged in the pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sensual desire have entered upon the wrong way, but says the pursuit is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is a wrong way, then one teaches only the Dhamma. When one does not say all those disengaged from the pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sensual desire have entered upon the right way, but says instead, the disengagement is a state without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, it is the right way, then one teaches only the Dhamma. When one doesn't say, all those engaged in the pursuit of self-mortification have entered upon the wrong way, but said instead, the pursuit is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the wrong way, then one teaches only the Dhamma. When one does not say, all those disengaged from the pursuit of self-mortification have entered upon the right way, but says instead, the disengagement is the right way, then one teaches only the Dhamma. When one does not say, all those who have not abandoned the fetter of being, but instead says, as long as the fetter of being is unabandoned, being too is unabandoned, then one teaches only the Dhamma. When one does not say, all those who have abandoned the fetter of being have entered upon the right way, but says instead, when the fetter of being is abandoned, being is also abandoned, then one teaches only the Dhamma. So I hope you got the point here, that you never criticize or praise the person. You just focus on the act. So those of you who've read my little book about opening the door of your heart, you see there that I put that in very simple terms, where the two children in the supermarket checkout, one drops the carton of milk, the other one drops the jar of honey. One mother says, you stupid child, the other one says, the stupid thing you did. One is actually extolling disparaging. The other lady was actually teaching Dhamma, according to this sutta. You're not praising or blaming the person. You are just focusing on the act. So, those of you who want to live a happy life with a partner, you don't say, you stupid husband, you came home late today. You say, it's stupid coming home late. It's the action you focus on, not the person. You don't praise the person and say, oh, you're such a wonderful wife, you're so beautiful. You're such a good cook. You say, your cooking is very delicious, darling. That is teaching Dhamma. You focus on the act, not the person. And if only our politicians would do that. You don't say the Labour Party is stupid. You don't say the Liberal Party is selfish. You don't say Mr. Bush is this way. You just will say that going to war is not a very good idea. You say, like, you know, selfishness is, or greed is a state beset by suffering. But you don't criticize a person for being greedy. You criticize the greed. You criticize the anger. You criticize the selfishness. That is teaching Dhamma. You praise generosity. You praise kindness. And you praise peace. So that way is no conflict in the world. There's no conflict in the relationship. There's no conflict in the company. There's no conflict in the monastery. So if a monk sort of sleeps in late and doesn't make it to the morning meeting, you don't say, "You lazy, good-for-nothing young monk." You just say, "No, sleeping in is not a very good idea." Do you see the difference? And this is like 2.5 millennia ago the Buddha saw that. It's how to avoid conflict. You know what extolling and disparaging is. You know what teaching Dhamma is. Don't extol. Don't praise that person. "Oh, you're so wonderful, you're so great." Praise the act. You don't disparage, "You stupid person. It's a stupid thing that which has been done." You disparage the act. And that way it becomes a state without conflict. Understand? Also with yourself. You don't say, "I'm a hopeless case. I can't meditate. Every time I go on a retreat, I always fall asleep and get a headache." You don't never disparage yourself. You teach Dhamma. Say, "Now, falling asleep. Actually, it's not that bad falling asleep, because most people need to be asleep. But getting a headache is not a nice thing to do." You don't disparage yourself, you disparage the act. You don't praise yourself and say, "Oh, I'm so wonderful. Look, I've just been on a 9-day retreat. I'm so great that sort of, you know, I've just been to the Dhamma class." You just say, "Going on a retreat is a good thing to do. But not me." So that's what extolling is, what disparaging is, and what teaching Dhamma is. A state without conflict. Is that clear? Can you do it? Don't go around criticizing anybody. Don't go around praising anybody. Just teach Dhamma. So no one is a criminal. You don't say, "You're a murderer, you're a criminal." You say, "It's a criminal thing you've done. It's a bad thing you've done." And that's a state without conflict. Okay. So it was with reference to this that it was said one should know what it is to extol, what it is to disparage. And knowing both, one should neither extol nor disparage, but one should teach only Dhamma. That's actually what's one of the reasons why my monastery is successful. You don't praise, you don't disparage people. You just praise only Dhamma. One should know how to define pleasure. And knowing that, one should pursue pleasure within oneself. So it was said, with reference to what was this said? Again, this is so very deep. Having started off with the middle way, people think, sensory pleasure, you can't do that. Self-mortification, you can't do that. The middle way must be boring. But it's because people don't understand what real pleasure is. So the Buddha is now saying one should know how to know real pleasure. And knowing that, what real pleasure is, one should pursue that pleasure within oneself. Now this is actually where I was said earlier, this is actually where we find the difference between what's called sensory pleasure and what's called non-sensory pleasure, the pleasure of the mind. And this is what I was referring to. Because there are these five chords of sensory pleasure. There's basically five types of sensory pleasure, sensual pleasure. What five? Forms cognizable by the eye, sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, and tangibles cognizable by the body. Each of these, things that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust or desire. These are the five causes of sensual pleasure. Now the pleasure and joy that arise depend upon these five types of sensual pleasure are called sensual pleasure. They call it, now this is interesting here, a filthy pleasure. You know what actually the actual word really is, which the translators here didn't have the guts to actually put in print? It's actually called Milhasuka, which literally means the best accurate translation is a pissy pleasure. That's what they actually call it, like urine. So basically a piss pleasure. A coarse pleasure, an ignoble pleasure. I say of this kind of pleasure that it should not be pursued, it should not be developed, that it should not be cultivated, that it should be feared. And that's actually the sensory pleasure which the Buddha said was going to lead to vexation and fever. He said it is like a pissy pleasure. Now, of course, that sounds a bit sort of anti any pleasure. But remember, this is in the context that you should know what real pleasure is and should pursue that real pleasure. Now we come across one of my favorite quotes, which many of you who know me would say, here we go, Zajan Brahm again. But it is straight from the sutta here. So what is the opposite? Here, monks, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, the pleasures of the sense are disappearing, secluded from unwholesome states, which means the five hindrances, a monk enters upon and abides in the first jhana, or the second jhana, or the third jhana, or the fourth jhana. This is called the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, the bliss of enlightenment. I say of this kind of pleasure that it should be pursued, that it should be developed, that it should be cultivated, and it should not be feared. So it was with reference to this that it was said, one should know how to define pleasure, and knowing that, one should pursue the pleasure within oneself. So you can summarize that up. That's a powerful teaching of the Buddha, just that section, saying that what real pleasure is not the pleasure of the five senses. Even the best thing you can see with your eye, the most wonderful sound, the most amazing scent, the most delicious of flavors, or the most agreeable of feelings in the body, that's called by the Buddha still piss pleasure. So, seeing a sunset, seeing a beautiful flower, seeing your baby born, that comes under that category. Listening to Mahler is one of my favorite composers when I was a student. Sort of smelling sort of fish and chips in an afternoon through your nose. Whatever else you like to smell, that's just my conditioning. Actually, you know my two favourite smells? My two favourite smells are actually batshit, and number two was tar, the smell of tar. And the reason is my favourite smells was because of the Second World War in London, because the government took all of the metal they could possibly find to make into tanks and shells to blow people up. Around the local parks, there used to be like metal railings, but they actually took them all away and replaced them with wood. Now, wood is not a very good idea in Northern Europe because it soon gets rotted or eaten up by rot or whatever. But because those early years when I grew up, in the local park, where I used to spend many hours in the evening playing soccer, playing with my friends, it was always being painted with tar, every maybe 6 months or something, to keep the wood from decaying. And so the smell of tar is associated with the happiness of my childhood. So whenever I smell tar, it's a beautiful smell for me. And the other smell, which I often say in my monastery, which shows you actually why we like some smells, we don't like other smells. The smell of batshit especially was because in Thailand I used to love meditating in the caves. And many of all the caves all had bats in, because the bats would live in there as well. It was their home. I shared their home. And I had such a wonderful time meditating in those caves in Thailand. To this day, when I smell batshit, it brings back the happy memories. And so it's one of the most delicious and beautiful smells. I love the smell of tar. I love the smell of batshit. Isn't that amazing? So if there's any lady who wants to try and seduce me, they should fear themselves. That's only a joke. So this is actually what we mean by sort of flavors or tangibles, whatever it is. They say that when one defines pleasure, it's a very low pleasure. There's something much, much better than that. And what the pleasures which the Buddha is saying you should pursue is the pleasures of the jhanas. First, second, third and fourth jhanas. And this is the bliss of renunciation. This is the bliss of letting go. This is the payoff of letting go. This is the bliss of seclusion. The bliss of peace. So what happens with peace? This is its taste, the taste of peace. And this is afterwards, when I first read this, I thought, wow, the bliss of enlightenment is actually called Sambodhisukha. Now, everybody who knows Buddhism knows the jhanas aren't enlightenment. And enlightenment is something a bit further than just the jhanas, but the only reason the Buddha could actually say that was that the jhana experience is so close to enlightenment that he gave it that word. This is not enlightenment, but this is something what enlightenment feels like. That's why he called it the bliss of enlightenment. And lastly, I say of this kind of pleasure that it should be pursued, that it should be developed, that it should be cultivated, and it should not be feared. Something which I quote very often. And sometimes some teachers come and say, oh no, you get attached to those jhanas, so much pleasure. And now you can see what the Buddha said here. No, do not fear them. It should be pursued, developed and cultivated. It leads to enlightenment. It doesn't block enlightenment. So, I'm going to extend that even further. Remember that the middle way is giving up the pleasures of the five senses. That's one type of pleasure. It was giving up self-mortification, the pain. So what's left? What can the middle way be? Of the six senses, the five pleasures, the pleasures of the five senses are ruled out, the pain of the six senses is ruled out, there's only one thing left. The pleasure of the mind. And that's why the jhanas are the middle way. The pleasures of the mind. Letting go of the pleasures of the five senses. Letting go of the pain of the six senses. Only leaves one thing to pursue. The pleasure of the mind. The pleasure of the mind is called jhana. It is the middle way. Yeah. Yeah. They have Vedana, they're all Vedana, huh? Because Vedana is just pleasure or pain. So it's just the that aspect of every sensory experience which is pleasurable or painful or in between. So that by elimination, that's all we have left. This is why the Buddha said you should pursue that pleasure inside. Okay, in the jhanas you don't have the body, but that's the body vedanas. I think, yeah, okay, I see where you're getting from, because some teachers actually just focus on the feelings in the body as being vedana, aches and pains, itches, but that's only just part of what the Buddha meant by vedana. Every time you see something, you know, don't see it with the physical body, you see it with your eyes. It's either delightful or it's repellent. It's ugly. That aspect of every one of the six senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching or knowing, the aspect of any one of those six which is pleasant is called pleasant Vedana. That aspect of that experience which is unpleasant is called unpleasant Vedana. It's a word which has no real translation in English, because it's a concept which we've lost. It's something which goes across all the senses, which is appealing, pleasurable, or repelling, ugly, unpleasant. It's with every one of the senses. So, including the mind, yes. Sorry? Yes, that is pleasurable vedana of the sixth sense. And the Buddha said that's the one to be pursued. Yes. Equanimity, real equanimity comes after one lets go of even the mind. That's the parinibbana, the real equanimity. One can say that there is equanimity of the five senses when one is in jhana, because one is not paying any attention to any of those things. What happens with equanimity, this is with the vedanas, that if it's there's no pleasure or pain, say, with what you're seeing, it's neither attractive nor repellent, the mind turns away, it turns off from that. The whole thing disappears. Simply because it doesn't engage the mind. Equanimity is what turns things off. So you cannot actually stay with equanimity for too long in the five senses. You can stay with it for the mind. But actually even the mind's equanimity, the Buddha said, that is a more refined pleasure. It is an inner pleasure. Yes. In a jhana state, because one is the path into a jhana state, is that one pays no attention to sight by closing the eyes. When you close the eyes, you see blackness usually. That is neither attractive nor repellent because it doesn't engage the mind. After a while, you stop seeing even blackness. It disappears. The sense of sight vanishes. You're not seeing anymore. You usually sit in meditation at the beginning in a place where there's not too much noise. There can be noise, but as long as it's constant. You can be next to a road as long as it's a constant hum and there's not sort of a sudden increase in amplitude of the noise and then a decrease. Because if it's constant, the ears will turn off. You won't hear them anymore. You sit still so the feelings in the body don't change. First we have equanimity to the body, and then it disappears. This is actually how letting go happens. When those five senses disappear because of equanimity in the five senses, just let go of, and then you're left with the mind. Yeah. That's a very good question. I have arguments with this. There is a couple of suttas in the Tripitaka where the Buddha actually sort of said that the Buddha discovered jhanas. The Buddha was the originator of the jhanas. And other people have also pointed that out, that before the time of the Buddha there would have been jhanas from a long, long time ago when there was a previous Buddha, but they were basically all forgotten. And the Buddha rediscovered those jhanas. He said in a very beautiful simile, he said it's like a person wandering through the jungle and they find this overgrown path, an old road to a great city. He said, I found that old road and I found that great city. The road was the Eightfold Path, which culminates in jhana. The eighth factor of the Eightfold Path is the four jhanas, Samma Samadhi. And the city which he discovered at the end of that road is Nibbana. So that was his simile which he discovered. Okay. Those two. Now this is the argument which we have. They couldn't have attained to those jhanic states. According to the texts, they say that they had the attainment, one of nothingness, that was Alara Kalama, and the other one, Uddhakarama Puja, had achieved a state of neither perception nor non-perception. Now that would have been impossible, to have achieved what was really meant by those two terms. Because those are always based on the ordinary jhanas. You cannot get to those states without going through what we know as jhanas. Now, that couldn't have been the case that they had the ordinary jhanas, because the Buddha said that when he sat under the Bodhi tree before his enlightenment, he recalled the only other time he'd experienced jhana in his life, which was as a boy under the rose apple tree. Because that was the only time he'd experienced the jhanas in his whole life, that's what he remembered. He was saying that under Alarakalam Uddhakaramaputta he never did the jhanas at all. Now, the way that can be understood and can be reconciled is to understand that even today there are some teachers who go around teaching jhanas, but they're not the real thing. They're less than what jhanas truly mean. And the reason why is that when people see the importance of jhanas from reading suttas, they realize that there's no way to become fully enlightened without those jhanas. They're necessary. So it's usually through wishful thinking that they lessen the requirement of a jhana. It becomes less than is really needed. A simile is that what one is needed to get, say, a degree these days is far less than what was needed when I was a young man, which is even much less than was needed, say, 100 years ago. I remember reading about medieval Europe. The great universities, and there was only a few of them, would only issue a doctorate maybe every 5 or 6 or 7 years at most to really exceptional students. To become a doctor, that was an amazing achievement. Only maybe 5 or 6 years would one be given. But these days, the doctors are churned out, 1,000 by every university. And the intelligence, the research, the achievement required these days is far, 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 far less than, say, in the Middle Ages in Europe. The standards always go down. And I think that's what happened. That what those teachers were calling those states were not the real thing. When the Buddha actually discovered the jhanas and got to those real things, then he knew the difference. That's the only way one can reconcile that sort of little argument. Right, this is actually why you come here. If you come to sutta classes, if you come to listen to a talk, and you only hear what you've heard before, if you only have your old ideas reconfirmed, there's not much point coming. The only reason to teach is actually to teach something fresh and new, to open the eyes. Go on. Well, actually, that he said he didn't learn anything which is of use. He said it's not conducive to enlightenment, what he learned there. And then, he didn't, no, it wasn't a self-mortification. He did a self-mortification afterwards. They didn't, no, but they weren't going far enough in letting go. It's hard to actually know exactly what they taught. But it seems to be more than likely, even though they didn't teach self-mortification, it's probably more on the side of self-mortification and sensory pleasures. And the reason I say that was, before the Buddha's enlightenment, that when he decided to walk what later he described the middle way, his five friends, who had been with him all on his 6 years' journey before enlightenment, the five ascetics, they left him. They said, you've given up the struggle, you've given up the path. And he became enlightened by himself in Bodh Gaya, alone, having been abandoned. Because his five ascetics said that what you're about to do is not the way to become enlightened. They rejected the middle way. And even after the Buddha, he ate, he bathed, and even under the Bodhi tree, he actually got some grass and actually made a nice soft cushion. And even today, some people in some forest monastery will say that's indulging. Sit on the floor and enjoy the pain. But the Buddha would not do that. To some people, the five ascetics thought he was indulging. They thought that's not the way to enlightenment. But the Buddha said that is part of self-mortification. You never get enlightened that way. He rebelled. He went along a path which no one had done, the middle way. And of course he became enlightened. And when he went back to teach his five ascetics at the deer park in Benares, as soon as they saw him, they say, this is a scallywag who's just left the path. You know, he's just indulging. He's not one of us. They wouldn't believe him at first that he could become enlightened in that path. Because those five ascetics left him. Obviously what the Buddha was doing was not being done by anyone else at that time in India. And it's a middle way which you can see by the Buddha's own experience led to the jhanas and from there to full enlightenment. You can see over here the Buddha actually says, I say this kind of pressure, it should be pursued. It should be developed. It should be cultivated. It should not be feared. So whether the Buddha discovered it or not, it should be cultivated. So it's with reference to this that it was said, one should know how to define pleasure, and knowing that, one should pursue pleasure within oneself. So the monks and the nuns who have given up the world are just people who pursue pleasure. I'm a pleasure pursuer. So we say that because that challenges some people's ideas of what Buddhism is, especially what monasticism is, that celibacy is. They think that celibacy is denying pleasure. But we're just following the Buddha's teachings of the pursuing the pleasure but in oneself, not pursuing pleasure in the world. Pursuing pleasure in oneself. So we have a good time. Any questions or comments on that? Okay. Now, one should not utter covert speech, and one should not utter overt, sharp speech. So it was said with reference to what was just said. Here, monks, when one knows covert speech to be untrue, covert speech is like behind people's backs. When one knows covert speech to be untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, one should on no account utter it. When one knows covert speech to be true, correct, and unbeneficial, one should try not to utter it. One should restrain oneself. So if it's wrong, one should certainly not say anything behind another person's back. Even if it is true and unbeneficial, true, correct, and unbeneficial, one should try not to utter it. So the first one, absolutely never utter it. The second one, please, please try not to. But when one knows covert speech to be true, correct, and beneficial, one may utter it knowing the time to do so. So when it's behind one's back, it may be, Abby, your sister, she's in a bit of trouble because of this, and I'm telling you right now, I know it's behind her back, but I think it's really beneficial, it's true. It's obviously a good thing to do. Or you may, go to a friend about what I just said and say, what Ajahn Brahm said, maybe he made a mistake there, maybe we should go and tell him this. If it's beneficial, go on and do it. So behind one's back, if it's beneficial, if it's correct and true, it's okay to do, but at the right time. And then there'll be no conflict. Too often though, we talk behind each other's backs and it's not true, it's not correct, it's not beneficial. We certainly don't do it at the right time. Therefore, it creates conflict. Sometimes there's a problem. It needs to be fixed. I tell the monks in my monastery, if a monk is having a hard time, come and tell me. So isn't that telling tales? I said, no, because then we can help the guy. So this is actually when we talk about another person, behind their back, as it were. They're not involved. If it's the right time, if it's correct, beneficial, then we do it. Common sense. We sometimes forget this. And overt speech, when one knows overt sharp speech, this is actually in front of somebody, to be untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, one should on no account utter it. But when one knows overt speech to be true, correct, and unbeneficial, one should try not to utter it again. But when one knows overt sharp speech to be true, correct, and beneficial, one may utter it, knowing the right time to do so. Remember, this is in front of a person, a bit of a sharp speech. In other words, you're telling somebody off. So now, Larry, you know, you shouldn't give the monk so much food. He said, oh, that really hurts, because I'd love to give the monks food. But you've got to choose the right time, the right place. But it has to be true, which is not true, so I shouldn't have really said that. That was only an example. We can understand what it means there. Sometimes we have to tell somebody off or give them some advice. It's sharp. Number one, it has to be true and correct. If it's true and correct but unbeneficial, then don't utter it. Don't say it. You know, what's the purpose behind this? Is it going to really solve the problem? If it's not going to prove any benefit to anybody, then keep quiet. Waste the time talking. But if it is beneficial, it's correct and true, you've also got to do the right time. And so, you know, I've told this before many times on a Friday night. If you're in a relationship with your partner, and there's something you have to tell them, it's true, it's correct, and it's a beneficial, one should choose the right time. Take your partner out to dinner, to an expensive restaurant. And at the last course, the sweet course, they're so soft and malleable, you can tell them anything. And they say, oh yes dear. It's the right time and place. You've got to sort of, you know, build them up to it. And it works. It's obvious. Do that at the monastery. If I tell the monks, if you want to ask me something special, you don't do it when I'm really busy. I just come back from a hard weekend at Nolamara. You know, you wait till sort of usually just after you've had a nice lunch. When you had a really nice lunch, because monks only eat just once a day, you come up to that monk after a great lunch, and I always say yes. It's obvious, isn't it? You're in a good mood. So choose the right time and place. So overt sharp speech, even if it's criticising someone, that's what sharp speech is. You can do that, but make sure it's correct and true, beneficial, and you choose your right time and place. Then there will be no conflict. This is what this is all about. Conflict within a monastery, conflict within a relationship, conflict within any community. So it was in reference to this that it was said, one should not utter covert speech, one should not utter overt sharp speech. Any question on that? Okay. One should speak unhurriedly, not hurriedly. And I slow down whenever I read this. So it was said, and with reference to what was this said? Here, monks, when one speaks hurriedly, one body grows tired, one's mind becomes excited, one's voice is strained, and one's throat becomes hoarse. And the speech of one who speaks hurriedly is indistinct and hard to understand. Now, the trouble is that when we do tell somebody off, we usually speak very quickly and harshly. So sometimes you don't understand what you're trying to be saying, what you're trying to say. You become excited, your voice is strained, and you're hard to understand. Here, monks, when one speaks unhurriedly, one's body does not grow tired, nor does one's mind become excited, one's voice is not strained, nor does one's throat become hoarse. And the speech of one who speaks unhurriedly is distinct and easy to understand. So it's with reference to this that it was said one should speak unhurriedly, not hurriedly. Have you ever noticed when you do get excited, especially with anger, you do start to speak more hurriedly than normal? That's why a good way of overcoming anger is to deliberately slow down your speech. Because that way, that just anger just can't really sort of grow. It's almost like you're holding it back, you're strangling anger. When you start to speak slowly, so don't get so excited. And also it means that, you know, you become understood. So, a great way of overcoming conflict. Have you ever noticed that when there's an argument, people start to become excited, the speech becomes more hurried and more excitable. It's part of conflict. Slowing it down can stop the conflict. I remember Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh saying he was in a demonstration once, walking in the front, and everyone started to get very, very excited and angry. Don't know what the cause was, but they were so upset and angry, they were getting violent. He deliberately slowed down the walk and told all the other leaders in front to slow down. So they all walked really slowly. So because they were in front, the whole demonstration, the whole line of people behind them also had to walk slowly. And that had the effect of cooling everybody's anger down. It's a very, very skillful means. When you walk slow, it's hard to be angry. When you speak slow, it starves a lot of anger of its fuel, it stifles it. So whether walking slowly or speaking slowly, some of the cause of conflict is undermined. If in Parliament they told the people to speak very, very, very slowly, it would be hard to have an argument or conflict. Any questions about that? Okay. One should not insist on local language and one should not override normal usage. So it was said, and with reference to what was this said? How amongst does there come to be insistence on local language and overriding of normal usage? Here monks, in different localities, they call the same thing a dish, a bowl, a vessel, a saucer, a pan, a pot, a mug, or a basin. So whatever they call it in such and such a locality, one should speak accordingly, firmly adhering to that expression and insisting only this is correct and everything else is wrong. This is how there comes to be insistence on local language and on overriding normal usage. So you just say, only this is right, you have to call it this thing, you can't call it anything else. And how amongst does there come to be non-insistence on local language or non-overriding of normal usage? Here amongst, in different localities, they call the same thing a dish, a basin, etc. So whatever they call in such and such a locality, without adhering to that expression, one speaks accordingly, thinking these venerable ones, it seems, are speaking with reference to this. This is how there comes to be non-insistence on local language and non-overriding of normal usage. So in other words, that people have different words for saying the same thing, so you shouldn't argue just on the fact that you did misunderstand their local language, their means of saying things. Too many times we argue not really understanding what the other person is saying. They are saying what we say. But sometimes we misunderstand and we argue. How many conflicts are there between different parts of Buddhism? Or between different religions and philosophies. We don't really understand what they're saying. They don't understand what we're saying. And we argue over the words. And sometimes we find, when we understand what they really mean to say, what we mean to say, we're saying the same thing. Sometimes just different words. And that can create wars. So don't just insist that your word for that thing is the right one, and the other ones don't understand. Yeah. Don't be a language fundamentalist, yes. Because it's true that sometimes that we argue over the same thing. What is the best drink? Some people say a cup of cha. Say, no, 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 a cup of tea is the best drink. No, no, a cup of cha. No, no, a cup of tea. Whatever it is. And sometimes we're arguing over the same thing. So, especially in religions and philosophies. Especially in like different parts of Buddhism. So, which is the best teaching? Zen Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism, sort of Mahayana Buddhism. Which is the best type of Theravada? The Thai tradition, the Sri Lankan tradition, the Burmese tradition. And the Thai traditions, the forest tradition, or the village tradition, or what tradition? And so we can argue about all these things. But are there really any differences there? If so, what are the differences? So stop arguing over just language. Okay, and that's it. So it's reference to this, that it was said one should not insist on local language and one should not override normal usage. And now, as usual, the Buddha just sums it all up again. Just when I was taught to give a talk, you say what you're going to say, explain it, and then by summing up, say what you said. Here, monks, the pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sensual desires, alone unbeneficial, is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and is the wrong way. Therefore, this is a state with conflict. Here, monks, disengagement from the pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasures is linked to sensual desires is a state without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and this is the right way. Therefore, this is a state without conflict. Here, monks, the pursuit of self-mortification, painful, ignoble, unbeneficial, is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever. It is the wrong way. Therefore, this is a state with conflict. Here, monks, disengagement from the pursuit of self-mortification, painful, ignoble, unbeneficial, is a state without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever. And it is the right way. Therefore, this is a state without conflict. Here, monks, the middle way discovered by the Buddha avoids both these extremes. It gives vision, gives knowledge, it leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. It is a state without suffering, and it is the right way. Therefore, this is a state without conflict. Here, monks, extolling and disparaging, and failure to teach only the Dhamma, is a state beset by suffering, and it is the wrong way. Therefore, this is a state with conflict. Here, monks, not extolling and not disparaging, and teaching only the Dhamma, is a state without suffering, and it is the right way. Therefore, this is a state without conflict. Here, monks, sensual pleasure, a pissy pleasure, a coarse pleasure, and a noble pleasure, is a state beset by suffering, and it is the wrong way. Therefore, this is a state with conflict. Here, monks, a bliss of renunciation, a bliss of seclusion, a bliss of peace, a bliss of enlightenment, is a state without suffering, and it is the right way. Therefore, this is a state without conflict. Here, monks, covert speech that is untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial is a state beset by suffering. Therefore, this is a state with conflict. Here, monks, covert speech that is true, correct, but unbeneficial is also a state beset by suffering. Therefore, this is a state with conflict. Here, monks, covert speech that is true, correct, and beneficial is a state without suffering. Therefore, this is a state without conflict. Here, monks, overt speech that is untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial is a state beset by suffering. Therefore, this is a state with conflict. Here, monks, overt sharp speech that is true, correct, and beneficial is a state without suffering. Therefore, this is a state without conflict. Here, monks, the speech of one who speaks hurriedly is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever. It is the wrong way. Therefore, this is a state with conflict. Here, monks, the speech of one who speaks unhurriedly is a state without suffering. Therefore, this is a state without conflict. Here, monks, insistence on local language and overriding of normal usage is a state beset by suffering. Therefore, this is a state with conflict. And here, monks, non-insistence on local language and non-overriding of normal usage is a state without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever. It is the right way. Therefore, this is a state without conflict. Therefore, monks, you should train yourself thus. We should know the state with conflict, and we should know the state without conflict. And knowing these, we shall enter upon the way without conflict. Now, monks, Subhuti is the clansman who has entered upon the way without conflict. Strange, actually, that sentence has been put in there. It's almost doesn't seem to fit in there. One doesn't really know why it's there. But anyway, that is what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. A sutta about conflict. Verbal conflict, religious conflict, even communal conflict. Any questions about that? Yeah, one, two. You got your hand up first. Yeah. It actually is covered, most of the precepts there. It has to be correct, which means, you know, you can't have lying speech. and it has to be beneficial, which means that much of the other wrong speech, like, you know, which is like calling someone a dog or stupid, or getting angry when you're actually talking to them, is actually it's a waste of time. Like, you know, the two types of speech, it's actually two types of speech. One is malicious gossip, one is like harsh speech. Harsh speech is just by its very nature, you're bawling someone out, you're shouting at them. And, you know, the person may hear what you say through the force of your delivery. They don't respect you. And if they do what you're told, it's only out of fear. And when you're gone, they will just carry on as they did before. It never really teaches them anything. So that we always use like soft speech, like caring speech. So if we are using harsh or sharp speech, you know, it's correct, true, beneficial, we always make sure that it's done in a soft and caring way. So the person realizes we have their best interest at heart. They're more likely to listen. I think you probably know from your own experience, when someone shouts at you, you know, you listen to them out of fear, but you don't respect them anymore. But when someone actually takes you aside and explains why, and they're not criticizing you, but they're just criticizing, you know, some of the things which have been done, then, you know, you can see, you understand the reasons, and you're more likely to change your ways in a positive course. So the okay, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's in any of these suttas that obviously that one cannot cover everything. So these are a patchwork, these suttas, and every one just focuses on one particular part of the path. And to focus on the whole of the path, to give the full teachings, you put all these different suttas together to get the full picture. But all the time, the Buddha would only focus just on an aspect of the path, the aspect of the teaching, would never actually fully cover it. But you can extend it a little bit to the other speeches, but when it comes to sort of killing and stealing and those sorts of things, it's not really covered here. Except maybe you say that all of those originate from like pursuing pleasures of the senses. Or self-mortification, I don't know, maybe killing yourself. Okay. Yeah, you have next. Yeah, true. That's a deeper meaning. Yeah. That's a deeper meaning of that, which is valid. What he was asking there was that when somebody asks a question, that sometimes you don't answer the question, you answer the questioner. So sometimes the people ask a question and they're hiding in their words, you know, what they really mean to ask. And the moment my teacher Ajahn Chah was brilliant at that. Sometimes if you read the question and you read the answer, the two don't match. But if you were there at the time and you knew the questioner, you understood that the Ajahn Chah really hit it on the spot. Sometimes because of either fear, because we're not articulate, we cannot really express what we really want to say. So we don't insist on that language, but we insist on where it's coming from and get the real meaning of what the person wanted to ask. That's answering the questioner rather than answering the question. But I think the ordinary meaning of what the Buddha was saying there, which came to my mind, was just before I went to Melbourne last week, I just finished editing the manuscript of Opening the Door of Your Heart for United States. It's going to be published there as well. But they're going to give it a new title, because Opening the Door of Your Heart so the people in the USA doesn't work for the US market. So they've used one of the stories on the truckload of dung. The title will be, Who Ordered This Truckload of Dung? Now I've asked some people, especially in Melbourne, that's a terrible title. You can't do that. And they're insisting on local language, an American edition. But obviously that I've also researched a lot of US monks and other people from the US, and they say that's a great title. There's also that, you know, that one of the stories in that book is about Ajahn Chah's saying that if you've got an itch on your bum, and you an itch on your head and you scratch your bum, then the itch never goes away. And if you ask any American, a bum is just a wanderer, an itinerant, a vagrant. I said, what do you mean you scratch a vagrant when you've got an itch on your head? No. It's either scratch your butt or you scratch your ass. Either way, either one works. So you cannot insist on local language if you have to actually adapt to your audience. Little things like that. So I think that's also some of it, what he means. So you shouldn't, if you're a Thai and you come here, some Thai monks who come here, they try and speak, but they insist on, like, not just Thai language, but Thai concepts of Buddhism, and it just doesn't work. There are some Thais who, they don't insist upon not just the language, but even the concepts, and they can adapt to, like, Western ways, and they're brilliant. Ajahn Chah was one who was like that. That's why he had so many Western disciples. It can be like a Burmese monk who comes here, who insists on the Burmese way of doing things. It's great for the people who have lived in Burma and the Burmese Buddhists. They think it's wonderful. But the Westerners, they sometimes can't relate to it. Doesn't feel. All the Tibetans can sometimes do that as well, and insist on the Tibetan language being learnt, and Tibetan customs and concepts being learnt. I think this is also what is meant by this. Don't insist upon that. Find out where those concepts, where those words are coming from, what they really mean. Then express it in the language of the people you're meeting. So if you're giving a talk here, you look at the audience and you use that language. If you're talking to somebody, say, you know, in a high school, you try and use that language. You know, that you don't mind not using sort of words, say, scratch your ass, which may be offensive to some people in some places, but it's the right thing in other places. When I told some of those stories in Singapore about, in that book about Ajahn Chah saying that in the future there would be not enough paper for notes, not enough metal for coins, in the future they'd have to use chicken shit for money, you know that story in the book. And I asked, sort of, is that okay in Singapore to actually say chicken shit over the radio? And they said, maybe about 2 years ago wouldn't be, but okay today, go for it. So I had to actually adapt to the local language. So it's okay. So actually that's also what is meant there. Even in presenting the Dhamma. I haven't heard this yet. Maybe it'd be interesting to get in our library, but Ajahn Sumedho in England, he's got a rap song. There's something like da 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 da, and they call him Lungpo in England. Da 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 da. And Lungpo said, this is the way it is. Da 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 da. And Lungpo says, now watch your breath. Da 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 da. And Lungpo says, I can't wait to listen to it. It sounds really funny. But like it's somebody who's, you know, does rap music, and they just, you know, use some of his sayings in the rap song, which is apparently what rap music is all about. And apparently it works. So it's not insisting on just, you know, the what you say will be the Thai respect, you know, for Buddhism, and you never ever sort of put that to sort of rap music. But it's not insisting on local language, it's adapting to the time and place. I think that's also what it means. sorry, I mentioned that, yeah. That was actually, remember, these were just examples where the fetter would be. These are all examples about praising and criticizing. And so you never actually say that those people who don't keep precepts are stupid. You never say that the Buddhists are good. You never say that the Muslim fundamentalists are bad. You just say that blowing up people is bad. You just say that being arrogant with your beliefs and not listening to others is bad. But that way you can see there's no conflict anymore. You're not criticizing a religion or a person or a group. You're actually focusing on the actions. And people will agree with you then, killing people is wrong. You're not saying you're wrong for killing. You're saying the killing is wrong. Not the person, but the act. Not the group, but what they do. So here was just an example. When it says, all those who have not abandoned the fetter of being. And actually, it's interesting here, are beset by suffering. All those who have abandoned the fetter of being are without suffering. That's extolling and disparaging. Instead, actually, one says that... One says that those who abandon... Okay. That when it says that you're abandoning, the fetter of being abandoned is the right way, then one is actually just teaching Dhamma. Not just saying if you've got the fetter of being, then you're wrong. If you haven't got it, you're a great person. You just say the abandoning is the right way. So you're praising the path, not the person. So the fetter of being, it's in here, we've already... by implication, looked upon the fetters of craving and ill will, almost actually symbolized by craving being the pursuit of sensory pleasure and ill will being self-mortification. There's another sort of fetter which is very more profound, the fetter of being, to exist. I want to be. And that is a very, very deep fetter. Where there is a sense of me, there will be a sense of me wanting to continue. The fetter of existence, of being. And that is, as I mentioned before, even more fundamental than the pursuit of pleasure. I often quote that when a person is about to die, and I'm talking here about materialists who think that once they die they're going to be no more, they would rather be in pain than have the pain disappear and not be at all. They're afraid. So that actually was almost like a proof that the desire to be is much stronger than the desire to be happy. Overrides everything, yes. And of course that actually comes up as you will experience in meditation. Because as you let go of things, this is almost your idea of yourself is being taken away. Your idea of being is being stripped away. Because for many people, to be is actually to do things in the world. The more they do, the more their sense of being is emphasized and strengthened. Which is why we usually define ourselves by what we do. I am a monk. I am a doctor. I am a psychologist. When we stop being a psychologist, sometimes people think their sense of being has also been destroyed. When someone has been like a sports player, they've been an Olympian, and next time they don't make it, their sense of being has almost been shattered. And they feel very, very a lot of suffering there. So sometimes our being is measured by our activity. And in meditation, one is giving up that activity. In meditation, one is letting go also of one's being. One can let go so far, and then very often there are barriers come across because one is not prepared to let go of oneself any further. That's why in these meditations, such as the jhanas, is the states of letting go. In those jhanas, there's no will left. The potential to do has been completely eradicated. So much of what you thought you were is just no longer there. That's why there are strange experiences. Not only are they blissful, but they're so pregnant with insights. That's why they're necessary for enlightenment. Yeah. Yes. Yes, yeah. The what, sorry? Yeah, the... Indeed. When, sorry, I didn't get the first part of the question. The okay, yes, yeah, yeah. Indeed, that is like a creativity there. And which gives you a lot of the pleasure of creating things. In the Buddhist cosmology, the level of heavens above the human beings is somewhat stratified. It's split up according to different pleasures in those realms. And you've got the pleasures of those who delight in creating. And then they have above that the level, the heaven of those who have power over others' creations, which is even higher. One, you may say, the dilettantes, the artists. And, you know, if you're doing science or maths, that is an art. And you have the same feeling when you actually crack an equation as you do when you write your masterpiece. It's the same feeling there. You've created something new. And there's others who are like the aesthetes who enjoy and have power over your creation. They come and see what you've done and say, what a wonderful person. They just cry over your experiments. Correct, yeah. And sometimes the amount of pleasure which you have is measured by the amount of suffering which went before. The more suffering it was to get there, the more pleasure you have when you arrive. So it's just actually a balancing of the books. It's the same when you win the lottery. The only reason why people get very happy when they win the lottery is because all the millions who don't win the lottery. The only reason at a sports competition why the person who wins 100 meters at the Olympics feels so happy is because of all the people who didn't win. If everybody won, would you be happy? And the more people who do lose, the more happy you are. Yeah. Arana means the conflict. Arana means conflict. Arana is non-conflict. And Vibhanga is like an exposition. It literally means like splitting it into parts, analysing it. It's the analysis of non-conflict. Yes, yeah. Yeah, it means, yeah, exposition, analysing it. So taking that little saying and elaborating it, finding out its true meaning. It literally means like splitting it into parts. The analysis is good, yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's a very common word. Okay, so I think we've gone over time, as usual. But never mind. So, thanks for listening. It's great to have all those questions and those comments. Now, has anyone got a suggestion for a fortnight's time for the class? Sorry? Chapter? Pseudo-48, okay. Which is? Don't know that one, is it? The Kosambiya. Oh, that's a great one. I love the Kosambiya Sutta. Great, the Kosambiya Sutta, 48. Okay, you have something there? No, that's in the Sanghita Nikaya. Yeah, find that for you afterwards if you want. Okay, so thank you for coming. Now we can actually pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, then we can go.
Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami. Supatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Saṅgho Saṅkhaṁ Namāmi.